Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Thank you for spending part of your day with me. Let the wild rumpus begin at the Morgan Library and Museum, where this week a new exhibition opened called Drawing the Curtain, featuring the work of Brooklyn's own Maurice Sendak. Fans of Sendak will recognize the rumpus reference from the classic children's book, Where the Wild Things Are. But how many of you know that after the book was published in 1963, and decades before it was made into a movie, Where the Wild Things Are was adapted into an opera with a libretto by Sendak himself? Here's a recording from the opera's coronation scene, which leads into the aforementioned rumpus. Best. It was one of Sendak's many professional endeavors. He also created theater sets and designed costumes for The Magic Flute and The Nutcracker. And now you can see hundreds of his storyboards and costume and set sketches at the Morgan Library and Museum. The exhibition was curated by Rachel Fetterman, assistant curator of modern and contemporary drawings. Welcome, Rachel.
Thank you.
And also joining us is children's book expert Leonard Marcus, author of Maurice Sendak, A Celebration of the Artist and His Work. Welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So Maurice Sendak and the Morgan Library had a long relationship.
Yes.
How would you describe it?
I think it was a relationship of mutual admiration. Maurice Sendak loved the Morgan's collections, and the Morgan loved him in return. So over the years, Sendak returned to the Morgan again and again to look at its collections. In particular, he loved the William Blake drawings, works by Domenico and Giambattista Tiepolo, and of course the Mozart manuscripts. And in return, the Morgan gave him three exhibitions during his lifetime. And in 1981, in fact, they showed some of the drawings from The Magic Flute.
And this, what we see in this current exhibition, he bequeathed to the Morgan, correct?
Correct.
So the exhibition focuses on five of his shows. Why these five in particular? I mean, there were dozens, but there were five specifically.
So there are about a dozen operas that he did. And when Maurice Sendak passed away, he left us all of his designs for opera and ballet. And the Morgan had selected to take five of the productions, five of the most important productions. They're also among the earliest productions. And to take all of the works from those productions. And it amounted to over 900 drawings. So this is an overwhelming amount. The complete sort of haul from all of the productions would have been completely overwhelming, thousands and thousands of drawings. So this is an exhibition that is celebrating that bequest by showing representative examples of the productions that we have in our collections.
You were busy as the curator.
Yes, yes. It was a lot of fun to sort of sift through all of these drawings and very challenging to narrow it down.
What did you use as your parameters? What were you looking for?
I was looking for some of the most inventive designs. I also wanted to select from various stages of his process. I wanted to have preparatory drawings, early stage drawings, as well as finished watercolors. And then we had all these pieces of dioramas that had been at one time assembled, but when we got them, they were disassembled. They were flat pieces, and I really wanted to be able to bring some of those together and recreate those three-dimensional dioramas for the show.
Leonard, let me bring you into the conversation. What kind of set designer was Maurice Sendak? How would you describe him?
Well, I think he thought of the picture book, which is the art form he was first known for, as a tabletop theater. So when he got to work for the big theater, he was expanding on an approach to visual storytelling that had been his practice from the very beginning.
So for the idea of it being three-dimensional wasn't a foreign idea to him. It sounds like.
No, not at all. And in fact, there are two wooden toys in the exhibition that he and his brother made when they were teenagers. They were playing with making pictures and visual things move and become alive. And so working for the opera and the ballet were the ultimate ways for him to bring his art to life.
Now I'm throwing around terminology, so I want to explain. Storyboards. When he would do storyboards for his sets, what does that mean?
So these are sequential drawings laying out the action. And this is the kind of thing that frequently filmmakers will use. And Sendak always used them for his own books, and he used them for his stage productions as well. And I've been told by people in the theater world that this is highly unusual. This is not something that a theater designer will typically do, but it's something that Sendak always did, and he considered it an essential first step in any in any project that he undertook.
And it's something that a picture book artist will always do, and it's a sort of a roadmap for what the book might become.
Oh, that's so interesting. It, are his set designs, I mean, from what I saw, they seem, we were talking about this off mic earlier, instantly recognizable as Maurice Sendak, that they really have his imprint on that. Did you find that in your curation?
I did find that. And I mean, I think I approached this project as many people will approach this exhibition, which is that I was familiar with him in this very limited sense of having seen, of course, Where the Wild Things Are and In the Night Kitchen. Outside Over There was a book that I had approached actually only after I undertook this project and then realized how important it was to him. But I was coming at him as sort of a novice to this world of theater design that he had participated in, not really aware of what he had done. And I was instantly completely charmed by the drawings when I saw them. And they did somehow feel familiar to me. And I think what's really amazing about Sendak is that he had different styles that he used. You know, I mean, the styles that he used from one book to the next were not always the same, and yet they all feel identifiably Sendak. And that was something that I think really drew me to this work in a way that I hadn't expected, not being someone who is an expert in opera or ballet.
My guests are Rachel Fetterman and Leonard Marcus. We're talking about the current exhibition at the Morgan Museum and Library, Library Museum, Maurice Sendak, A Celebration. Excuse me, it's called Drawing the Curtain. The name of your book, Leonard, is Maurice Sendak, A Celebration of the Artist and His Work. Did Maurice Sendak seek out these commissions, or did people come to him?
People came to him, yeah. And it it was a kind of wonderful serendipity. Frank Corsaro, the opera director, was looking for someone to do the sets and costumes for The Magic Flute. And as a father and as a reader of books, Frank Corsaro had a number of Maurice Sendak's picture books at home. And he thought to call him out of the blue. And Maurice Sendak, unbeknownst to Frank Corsaro, was a huge opera nut, you know, going back from when he was a young person. And Magic Flute and Mozart were the absolute touchstones for him in terms of artistic achievement. So for him to be called on the phone one day and asked to do the work for The Magic Flute was really a dream come true.
You mentioned in the catalog of the book for the exhibit that Mozart was so important to Sendak, and also he used to come to the Morgan to experience Mozart. Will you explain that?
Sure. Well, in particular, in 1987, he came to the Morgan as part of the filming of a documentary about his passion for Mozart. He was so in love with Mozart. And he was, you know, rifling through original manuscripts by Mozart. And he was so inspired that he created one of his so-called fantasy sketches, which were drawings he had made throughout his life, which were his responses in drawing to music. And the way that I concluded the exhibition was to show one of these fantasy sketches that was drawn in direct response to a manuscript that he saw at the Morgan. And so you can see that he has this abiding and enduring love of Mozart that he was able to somehow translate into his graphic language.
Yeah, I'm interested in these fantasy sketches because they are throughout his life. What was their purpose? Was it just for him?
It was for him. He did an exhibition in 1970, and that was sort of, I think, the coming out for these drawings. It was the first time that he had shown them publicly. And, you know, he's described them variously. He kind of referred to them as, you know, the only kind of homework he had ever enjoyed. But I think in a way, for him, it was a kind of substitute. It was his way of composing. He has said that he always was sort of heartbroken that he couldn't be a composer. You know, as brilliant as he was as an illustrator and an author, I think if he could have had his way, he would have been a brilliant composer. And drawing these wonderful series of vignettes to music was the closest that he could come with collaborating with his composer heroes until, of course, he was invited to design for the stage.
I'm curious. Yeah. Okay.
I was just going to say, in addition to that, I mean, he was very interested in the unconscious. And when he was doing these sketches, he was letting his unconscious come to the fore, I think.
I love that. I'm curious if he approached his children's books the same way he's approaching these costumes and these sets. Because I'm looking at this page, I'll turn it around. There's so much detail and there are so many notes about the costumes, how they'll work, and the way that the actor or the singer will be inside of them. Were all of his sketches this detailed?
Yeah. I mean, there are a number of notebook pages with very preliminary sketches and ideas. But what's really stunning is how prolific he was and how highly finished a lot of even the early drawings are. And so you'll actually see that he'll, you know, for the Magic Flute, for instance, there are two drawings for one set that he made in the course of a single day. And, you know, they're preliminary, but they're highly detailed. And I think that he was so inventive and he just had such a vision for what he wanted to achieve, that he really was able to turn out all of these incredible drawings within a very short period of time.
Did he approach his children's books the same way?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, Where the Wild Things Are began as something called Where the Wild Horses Are, a little book that he created about 7 years earlier. And he was, as with these fantasy sketches, he was trying to find the story as he went along and couldn't figure out what the little boy was on a quest for in the original version. So he put it in a drawer for 7 years and then illustrated all kinds of other things, came back to it, and in the space of about a month, every day or two would write a new version of the story that became Where the Wild Things Are. I've looked at these manuscript pages, and a lot of them are just gobbledygook, but in every one of them, there's this like this one little phrase or word that you recognize from the book as it finally emerged. So he was really digging deep into himself and willing to try anything until he finally got exactly what he wanted. So yes, he was a perfectionist, and sometimes he would scrap illustrations that he'd done for a book and try them in a different medium.
Did that transfer over to the libretto for Where the Wild Things Are? That sort of attention to detail?
So I have to say, I don't know that much about the writing of the libretto for Where the Wild Things Are. There's a lot of kind of invented language in that libretto, where it's a sort of hybrid of Yiddish and something else. You know, the wild things speak in a kind of Yiddish hybrid language. But I have to say, that's something I do wish that I knew more about, was the actual writing of that libretto.
But, and I don't know for sure either, but I would think the answer has to be yes, because it's a very distilled kind of writing. You know, people think of picture books as simple, but really they're distilled. And it's a boiling down of things to their real essences, you know. And there's a musicality to the words, and that wasn't by accident.
Why do you think it translated well into an opera?
I think because the emotions are so primal, you know, and so big in a way, you know, the gestures, the little boy staring down the monsters and being crowned and then swinging in the trees. Those are all very operatic gestures.
And I love the sketch of the costume, of the Wild Things costume, because we recognize the costume, but his details are, he's saying, eyes must move, megaphone inside of head. He's written a sandal arrangement to keep the foot snug. He's that detailed and that interested in what will become of this costume. I found that fascinating. The name of the exhibit is Drawing the Curtain. My guests are Rachel Fetterman and Leonard Marcus. We're talking about Maurice Sendak. His work with ballet, what ballets did he work on?
So he really only did Nutcracker. In the
Just
90s,
Nutcracker.
there was a ballet version of Where the Wild Things Are. But really, the primary ballet that he did was Nutcracker. And this was a commission by Pacific Northwest Ballet in Seattle. And the artistic director there was Kent Stoll. And he was really very reluctant to take on Nutcracker because he really felt that he was being pigeonholed. And the one thing he never wanted to be was pigeonholed.
Because it was geared towards children?
Exactly, exactly. And so what he did, which is really brilliant, is he went back to E.T.A. Hoffman's original story, the story upon which the Nutcracker Ballet is based, and he really extracted some of the darker components of the story, and he was able to create a kind of real Sendak version of Nutcracker. And that was the standard Nutcracker in Seattle for over 30 years. It was only retired a few years ago.
Wow. You know, there's a suggestion that some of the work, and maybe even the Nutcracker he created, was a bit of a self-portrait?
Yes,
is that true?
I do think that he inserted himself into a lot of his work. You know, in Where the Wild Things Are, the first visual that the audience mm-hmm. saw was this wild thing called Moishe peering out from the foliage. Mm-hmm. And Moishe was, as many people knew, was something that Sendak himself had been called as a child, and that was an avatar for himself. And in Nutcracker also, there's a show curtain with this, you know, grinning, gritted teeth, Nutcracker with wide, wide green eyes. And Sendak actually called that a self-portrait, and we have a really great preliminary sketch where he writes self-portrait.
Mm-hmm. There's also, as part of the exhibition, there are 3D elements. It's not just sketches. What else can people see in our final minutes?
So we have the dioramas that we've reconstructed from some of the, mm-hmm. the portal pieces and models. We also have some costumes. We have a wonderful costume of a figure called Tiger Boy that Sendak invented for his version of Nutcracker that's on loan from the Pacific Northwest Ballet. Mm-hmm. We have a really beautiful owl head from Cunning Little Vixen. And we've got some three-dimensional models also from Cunning Little Vixen, as well as some props and costume elements from The Love for Three Oranges, just to really bring these things to life.
Leonard, is there one set of sketches you think people should pay attention to, you think really sort of get to the essence of Sendak?
Oh, well, there's one where he's drawing on what appears to be musical staves, you know, and it's almost like he's drawing, but he's composing at the same time. So he's really mixing the art forms in the most fluid and organic way. And it's so beautiful because it feels like the realization of this wish that he had to write music as well as to draw.
There's so much to see at the Morgan Library Museum. The name of it is Drawing the Curtain. Rachel Fetterman, Assistant Curator of Modern and Contemporary Drawings at the Morgan, and Leonard Marcus, author of Maurice Sendak, A Celebration of the Artist and His Work. Thank you so much for coming to All of It.
Oh, thank you.
We'll have more of All of It after a quick break. We'll get you up to date on Freestyle Love Supreme. Stay with us.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.